This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming, only on Hulu.
This episode is brought to you by Smart Food Popcorn. Some decisions aren't the best, like skipping ahead in your favorite podcast. Think of all the banter you'll miss, the lore in the making. Luckily, Smart Food Popcorn is a no-brainer. Deliciously tasty and available in a variety of fun flavors. It's a smart decision every time. Smart Food. Add smart. To learn more, visit smartfood.com.
Standard issue for all women.
Hello, Jen here to tell you about this week's episode of The Sunday Chops, in which I chat to writer Liz Jensen. But before I do, do you like us? Do you love us? Do you want to help us on our quest to make more women-focused, centred, championing, whatever you want to call it, ear fodder? Well, look, you're in luck, because we'd like that very much. We are working on our Patreon content, and there is going to be more coming soon. So if you're already signed up, thank you very much. And if you're not, you're about to be in for a treat. But you can already sign up now and go ad-free, if you like that sort of thing, for not very much cash at all. And that's over on patreon.com/standardissue. If you're happy with what you've got, thanks very much. Cool, we appreciate you and your listens nonetheless. But we've got some quality stuff coming up, including interviews with Jenny Kleeman, Anushka Warden and Holly McNish, to name but three. So get yourself subscribed for £0 and you won't miss a thing. And it will really help us out. Also, do us a review on your podcast platform of choice. We love those, especially if you give us 5 stars, innit? Anyway, that's my admin done. Back to chops. It probably hasn't escaped your attention that today is Mother's Day, a great day for some and a bit of a shitter for others. I send you my love wherever you fall on that massive and extremely complicated spectrum. This week's Chops guest, Liz Jensen, is known for her fiction writing, but has just published a memoir, Your Wild and Precious Life, on grief, hope and rebellion, about the death of her son, Raphael, in 2020, aged just 25. Raphael was a zoologist and ecological activist, and in her book, Liz writes about the experience of losing a child and her fight for the future of our planet in his name. It's quite a remarkable read, and I do recommend it, but I also hope that you enjoy hearing Liz speak about it as much as I enjoyed talking to her, and that if you are missing someone today, that you take some comfort from her story. I'm joined on the Zoom by writer Liz Jensen, who's here today to talk about her new book, Your Wild and Precious Life. Hi, Liz. Thank you so much for joining me.
Well, thank you for having me.
First of all, Liz, your book, Your Wild and Precious Life, is absolutely astonishingly beautiful. Could you tell us a little bit about what the book is about?
Thank you for saying it's beautiful. It means a lot to me. It's about the death of my son. So whoever's listening, please don't turn off now, because it's such a scary thing to hear about, is a child's death. It's what we all fear more than anything as parents. And I had this very, very strange premonition, even before he was born, that I was going to lose a child. So that makes it even more sort of weird and alarming. But it's not just about the death of my son, Raphael. It's really about what I learned in the wake of his death and the journey that I went on. I went on this crazy, I mean, you're mad. After you lose a child, you go nuts. And I certainly did. I didn't know who I was, what I was for. You know, was I even still his mum? Can you still be the mother? Can you still mother a child when they're dead? So I did a lot of reading, a lot of introspection, a lot of deep, deep grieving. And I came up with all sorts of answers, some of which contradicted each other. But given that what happened, happened, I am really glad that I went on that journey of discovery, because You're not the same person after your child dies. You're not the same person after anyone you love dies, or any way of life that you might cherish is gone. You're just not the same. So it was really a question of thinking, well, what matters to me now? What's important now? And I think death is very radicalizing. Nothing looks the same. One of the themes of the book is the way that the dead live on. Now, before Raphael died, I was, you know, had this very mechanistic worldview and, you know, didn't believe, I didn't have faith in any religion. I had just always thought, I just don't have that part of me that some other people really do seem to have. But really, very shortly after he died, I saw something. I saw the most amazing bird that appeared in front of me and seemed to do a little dance. And it had a long red tail. And he had this beautiful long red braid down his back. And it did this dance. He was an astonishing dancer. One of many things my son was an amazing dancer. And it seemed to be saying, here I am. And I just thought, yeah, you're there. You're still around. And it felt really magical. And okay, you could say I was in deep grief, and you know, people who are in grief, they see their dead ones everywhere, or they see signs and so on. But I actually really felt he was there, and I still do. I really still do feel he's still around. And I think a lot of people who have lost somebody have that feeling, but they don't want to say it aloud because it sounds a bit embarrassing. And, you know, oh, I saw my father as an owl, or I saw, you know, I saw the ghost of somebody. Why be embarrassed about that? If you saw it, you saw it. If you felt it, you felt it. So I made a point in the book of just owning those moments and saying, I can't explain them, but this is what happened. And the real feeling that he's still with me in some form, in some dimension, that's just a, you know, a blink away from where we are, that has really sustained me.
It's very relatable what you just said. My eldest brother died when I was 21 and he was 25.
I'm so sorry.
It's a while ago now. But yeah, the point that you made just then about, like, can you be a mother to, it's a funny question, isn't it? When it's someone that close to you, that sort of immediate, when people ask you very basic questions like, how many brothers and sisters do you have? Or in your case, how many children do you have? And it's a bit like, how many do I have? I'm not really sure what the answer is anymore.
Funnily enough, I did know quite a few people who had lost children before my son died. And when I met one of them first time and I asked her, how many children do you have? She said to me, that's quite a difficult question for me because I had five. And now I have four. But the way I see it, I still have five. And that stayed with me. I remembered it after Raph died. And sometimes I say that, well, I that's a difficult question for me. I had two and now I have one. And the one I have is still very real and alive to me. It depends on who you meet and what the context is. But I think all of us parents who've lost children, we struggle with this. It's such a normal question. No one should feel bad about asking you, how many children do you have? I ask people how many children they have. You know, every now and then you're just bumped by a normal question that just hits you sideways. So you have to be a bit prepared for what you might say. And I feel I can't say I only have one. It feels like a betrayal. It does feel like a betrayal.
It's such an entry-level question, isn't it, in getting to know someone. And then it's such a sort of personal thing to have to reveal in that. And as you said, when we started, like, don't switch off now because it's scary. and then it's a bit like, oh, God. And people are kind of like, oh, like, because also, you know, particularly with young people, when they die, there is an element of fear, like, oh, what happened to them? Could it happen to me? Could it, you know, it's, yeah, I think it's really difficult, isn't it? I wanted to ask you, because you write on your website that you're a very private person. I wonder what made you want to write about Raphael's death. Did it feel like sort of part of the grieving process for you? Because obviously you are a writer. So is that kind of how you process things?
Very much so. I mean, it's my therapy. Writing has always been my therapy. And in the past, it's taken the form of novels. But this time, I didn't begin writing it thinking I was writing a book. I wrote notes to myself. If you can picture this, I mean, I was completely thrown and devastated. And for the months after he died very suddenly. He had an undiagnosed heart defect, which just manifested when he was out running one day and he collapsed and died. And unfortunately, it's something that kills like 12 young people a week in the UK, possibly more, because some of those deaths are misdiagnosed. So I lay on the sofa. I mean, I was like one of these Victorian, you know, invalids who has to lie down all the time. I couldn't even stand up. I lay down on the sofa and I took out the notes on my phone and I just wrote notes to myself about what I was feeling, what was going on, strange things that had happened or I'd noticed, looking at pictures of him, you know, the memories came flooding back, of course. He was very, very vivid to me. He'd only just died. We'd been talking very, very frequently on WhatsApp in the months before he died. And we were very, very close. It started as notes to myself. Most of them were extremely self-pitying and just, you know, I would cringe to read them now. But as the months went by, I began sending these batches of notes to myself on email and just put together a folder and a file. And I realized I had written a lot and some of what was in there could become a book. And that was about sort of 9 months into the process, I realized that. And when he died, I read all the books I could by people who had lost children or about, you know, death generally, bereavement, the afterlife, all those things that I was desperate to find out about. I found some really good books, but I couldn't quite find the book I needed. And I suppose I thought what I want to do is write a book that can not just help other parents who've lost children or other people who've been bereaved, but help the people who know people who've lost children or have been bereaved. Because death is not spoken enough about in our society. You know, we try and sort of brush it under the carpet. And that was enraging to me. I couldn't bear it when people who I knew would cross the street to avoid me. And they did it out of fear. I know that. It wasn't because they're bad people. They just did it because they couldn't think of what to say. And the thing is, when you've lost someone, what you need is people just to put a hand on your arm and say, I'm so sorry. It's really simple. They're really small, simple things you could do. But I was getting a lot of that. But I was also noticing that some people were just steering clear of me. And that was easy to do because it was 2020 and it was a pandemic and we weren't really seeing people anyway. But I think there is a fear of death. And, you know, centuries ago when, or even 100 years ago, when death was much more common, the death of young people was more common in wars or to diseases and so on. I think it was more openly spoke about in Victorian times. You could wear a black armband to show that you were bereaved. And I remember thinking, oh, if I were ever to set up a company, which I would never do because I wouldn't be capable of it, I would set up a black armband company so that you could, you know, that undertakers and funeral homes and priests and everyone else could hand out to people when they lost someone. And it's just, it would be a lovely sign to just say, okay, just be gentle with me because I'm having a bad time.
I think a lot of the time, and this kind of ties into that fear, particularly around the death of young people, I think people want to kind of talk about the hows and the whys because people want to understand how awful things happen so that they can avoid them, I guess, themselves. But obviously, you know, you can't avoid all tragedy. I want to talk to you about the person, your son. He sounds like a remarkable young man. Can you tell me a bit about Raphael?
He was amazing. He was a simply extraordinary young man. I'll start with him as a baby, though, because he was a weird baby. He just came out weird. He didn't behave like my older son. He was kind of otherworldly. He had a very deep voice. And that's weird coming from a baby. Yeah. You know, when you give birth and your little baby comes out and they normally go, he went, you know, this sort of deep sort of, and I thought, what is this? What have I given birth to? And it sort of carried on like that. He was just quite unusual. And he became a very eccentric child. He was a very eccentric child. He knew exactly what he wanted. He didn't ask questions, which is quite unusual for a child. He developed theories about things, and then he would tell you his theory about how the world worked, and it was usually completely wrong. But and he was quite stubborn, you know. He would insist that, you know, the squirrels act crazy because they're drunk on rotten apple juice, and you just in the end go, okay, Ralph, you know, maybe that's true. He was fascinated by wildlife when he was tiny, and, you know, in the garden with snails, worms and insects and squirrels and foxes. And so that just continued, and he became a zoologist after a spell of being a child actor. That was also part of his life. He was in 3 feature films and 1 short. And he loved acting, but he'd never wanted to be an actor when he grew up. He just wanted to be a child actor. He didn't want to do theatre. He only wanted to do film. And he was very good at it. And it taught him a lot, I think. You know, he wasn't afraid of cameras. He wasn't afraid of presenting himself. He was very good sort of on the media side later on when he became a climate activist in Extinction Rebellion. He ran their social media when it was just all starting up. You know, he was there from the very, very beginning. And he was very good at it. So he was never into promoting himself at all. He was quite private in the way I have been quite private. But he was very, very passionate about the climate and ecological emergency and what could be done to slow it down, stop it, change the course we're on. I am too. And it was lovely to have that thing in common. So he was private, and yet he could do the public. He could do public interface, if you like, in a way that was very, very impressive and powerful. And he loved taking photographs. He was very, very good natured photographer. He was a good writer. He wrote articles in a zoological magazine. He did so much before he died. I mean, it's incredible to think how much one person can pack into a life that's only lasts for 25 years. And he did. He did.
So you mentioned there that you're passionate about the discussion around climate justice as well, and you've been writing about that and talking about that for a while. Was it your involvement in that? Was it your interest in that spurred on Raft's, do you think? Or was it the other way around? Did you become interested because he was passionate about it?
I mean, I did talk about it at home, and he was aware of it from a young age, but not concerned. I wouldn't say he was particularly concerned because he was a child, you know, and you don't want to burden your children too much with what you know. But I think what happened was when he studied zoology, or when he realized that, you know, wildlife was going to be his thing, he saw the extent of the ecological emergency, because he was working, either volunteering or working, in places where they were protecting wildlife. And he saw, you know, things like poaching, and he saw the devastation of habitats, wildlife habitats, and logging. And, you know, he worked in the Amazon, he worked in North and South America, he worked in Indonesia and in Africa. You know, he really traveled around and saw a lot of these places, and it was just devastated by how bad it was. I don't think he had realized how bad it was until he saw it on the ground. And that's what really fired him up. For me, it was always more about, you know, the atmosphere. I was much more aware of geography and geology and the way the temperatures were just shooting up and are just shooting up, and the fact that nobody's talking about it. And I think it's, in a way, it's like the death of a child. It's too big and too scary to confront. But the thing is, if we don't confront it and deal with it, then it's even worse, because suppressing something awful doesn't make it go away. Mm. It just defers the problem. So I think there is a kind of parallel there.
All right, Mickey here with an advert for BetterHelp Therapy Online. You all right? Such a small question, and sometimes such a big question too, eh? Now, regular listeners will know I am no stranger to depression, and while over time, and with the help of some decent counselling and brilliant friends and family, I've established a toolkit to help when the constantly dripping tap of life gets a bit too much, that does not mean I am a stress-free human rainbow skipping through meadows. I mean, who is? We all carry around different stresses, big and small, and sometimes we can deal, and sometimes it's much harder to cope. Life, innit? Right now, I have a teenage puppy to deal with, and although I love her very, very much, she can be a lot. There,
said it.
And as quick a fix as it seemed to say, I'm fine, and push it all down into the big inside box and put that lid on.
For me, that hasn't been a great long-term solution, in that if I don't get it off my chest, it will at some point come bubbling up, and it's never been one to pick its moments in a good way. I find talking means I can avoid it exploding out of me like a messy emotional volcano all over my nana's carpet. Also, during my various times in talk therapy, I discovered that saying something out loud or writing it down can make it seem much more manageable than allowing it to swirl around and grow ever bigger in my head. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. I've found knowing how to reach out is sometimes the toughest bit, but BetterHelp is entirely online. Boom. Which means it couldn't be easier. You just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a registered therapist, then work your sessions around your schedule. With more than 1,000 therapists in the UK already, BetterHelp can provide access to mental health professionals with a wide variety of expertise in mental health. Standard Issue listeners get 10% off their first month at betterhelp.com/standard. That's betterhelp.com/standard.
I wanted to ask you a little bit about that, because people talk about sort of climate anxiety. This is sort of a relatively new expression. No one really talked that much about climate change when I was young, when I was at school. I mean, we are talking sort of, you know, 20 plus years ago now, but that's not that far back, really. And yeah, people only really started talking about it in the kind of mainstream around the time of the Stern Report, which was 2006, because I worked for DEFRA at the time. And then it kind of became a much bigger deal in kind of like mainstream conversations. But I think a lot of older people are still not particularly kind of keyed into this subject. How real and pressing a concern is this topic to young people, do you think?
I think to some young people, it's a huge and very, very pressing concern. And to other young people, they just would rather get on and have fun and live their lives. What I would say is you can actually do both. You cannot live in a state of climate anxiety or climate grief all the time, you know, without going under. So I think that's why in Extinction Rebellion, for example, is this idea of having some time out to regenerate and get your head back. It's really important, because you can't go back on knowing what you know. You can't unknow it. But every now and then, you need to take a little pause. You need to take a breath, step back a bit, and look after yourself. So, yeah, I think it's a very mixed picture with young people. And I think it's really important that we don't just diagnose ourselves with climate anxiety, and then, you know, then it becomes another diagnosis that you can say, well, I suffer from this and I suffer from that, because it is a state that we're all in to some extent. And I think the people who deny climate change the most are often those who are suppressing it, who are aware of it actually on some very deep level and simply can't face it because it's so big and so terrifying, and it doing something about it does imply doing something about capitalism itself. And people don't like the thought of that, because it means changes in the way we live and so on. But it's like grief. You can't sweep it under the carpet and pretend it's not happening. On the other hand, we mustn't close our eyes to the darkness, but I think it's also really important to see the light. not in an evangelical way, but to just see, enjoy the good times, enjoy the wonderful moments that every life brings. And again, there's a parallel with grief, because one of the things that helped me emerge from my grief and helps me to this day is just appreciating the small good things. You know, I can look out of the window and say, well, there are no birds in the sky. I live in a city, and we don't get very many birds just flying around in Copenhagen, not as many as we should, and not as many as there would have been in that childhood. Or I can look out my window and just see the most beautiful pigeon landing on the balcony and pecking around and noticing how gorgeous a simple pigeon can be. So just really savouring the things we have left, the things that are still there, because that's so important.
Absolutely. You've mentioned, obviously, Raphael's involvement with Extinction Rebellion. In the book, you kind of detail, you know, instances like getting arrested during protests and things like that. So I wondered, did it ever worry you, his involvement in that? And I also wondered, when you see reactions to groups like Extinction Rebellion, some people can be quite dismissive and talk about the sort of inconvenience of it. It's something that always really pisses me off about the discourse around strikes, for example. Like, oh, I can't, you know, get the train somewhere. Like, that's literally the point.
Yeah.
That's why they're doing it.
It's not, all about me.
It's supposed to make things difficult. I wondered if the reaction to groups like Extinction Rebellion, how does that make you feel? Does it irritate you?
Well, yes, it does. It does irritate me because, you know, no one decides, oh, I'm going to become an activist, so it means I can mess up other people's lives by making their journey to work more difficult. That's not why any of us are doing these things. And by the way, it's now been made by this government almost impossible to protest in this country. And that is an infringement of everybody's human rights, not just the human rights of, you know, Extinction Rebellion activists, the human rights of anybody who wants to speak out about just about anything. So, I mean, I think more and more people are going to realize, perhaps belatedly, that everyone who's been protesting was doing it for the sake of everyone else and the sake of something that is much bigger than all of us, which is the home we live in, you know, the shared home we have, which is our planet. And when it comes to what you asked about, was I worried? Yeah. And I'm embarrassed that I was worried. Yeah. At the time he died, my biggest worry was that he was going to go to jail for vandalizing the Brazilian embassy in London. He was going to be up for trial. And that trial was actually postponed because of COVID after his death. And in the end, the others he was going to be tried with, I think they got 3 months suspended sentences and had to wear one of those cuffs for a while. So he used to get quite angry when I told him how worried I was about it. And he kept saying, I'm not going to go to jail. I'm not going to go to jail. And sort of remember after he died thinking, well, you didn't go to jail, you died. And that was so much worse. So I could have worried about a lot of things because he led quite a dangerous life, like all wildlife biologists who work in the field do. You know, he worked with dangerous animals. He got dengue fever on one occasion. He became unconscious halfway up a mountain when everyone got sick. And, you know, there are lots of things that he probably never told me and I'll probably never know. And then when there was something like the dengue fever, he told me 3 months later, oh, I had dengue fever. And he did. But there was a point when he was 18 and he looked very young then, or 18. He left school at 17. He made a lot of money from his acting. And so he was able to, you know, fund a year's travel around the world, working in various places with wildlife. And I was terrified. You know, there was this boy who just had his first tattoo. And that had gone wrong because as soon as he got to Mexico, he went on the beach with a fresh tattoo and it got infected. You know, I was thinking, I could spend my every single waking day worrying about Raph. And then we WhatsApped or Zoomed or whatever we did back then. And I told him I was worried. He said, you've just got to stop this. You've just got to trust me. And I realized, yeah, I do, because otherwise I'm going to drive myself mad. So I simply stopped worrying about him. I mean, apart from being arrested and going to jail, I think I was pretty good about not worrying about Raph. And I'm glad I didn't, because in the end, the thing he died of was something I couldn't have known about. It was invisible, it had no symptoms, and it just came totally out of the blue. So thank God I didn't worry about the other stuff and just supported him as much as I possibly could.
You quote the poet Mary Oliver in your book. Someone sent this to you after Raph died, and the line is, someone I loved once gave me a box of darkness. It took me years to understand this too was a gift. I wondered if you were eventually able to make sense of that and unpack that.
Yes. I mean, I'm still unpacking the box of darkness, but yes, I am also seeing that there, given that it happened, there are things that I have discovered and investigated I would never have gone into.
I would have just carried on living my fairly superficial life, which was a good life. I enjoyed it. And yeah, if I had the option of having him back, I'd take it like a shot and go back to that life. But I can't. So given that it happened, yes, a gift in some form. And I'm still trying to work out in exactly what form. But I certainly feel that I'm a deeper person. I've sort of discovered things in myself, including resilience, which I think everybody discovers only when they need to and not before. So yes, I guess that I was very glad to have been sent that quotation.
It's a beautiful quotation. And yeah, I mean, it made sense to me.
And the title of the book too comes from a poem by Mary Oliver, in which she says, "What is it you plan to do with your one wild and precious life?" So that's another tribute to her, the title.
This book was published on the 7th of March. As I said, it's astonishingly beautiful. It's so beautifully written. I would absolutely recommend that people go and seek it out. What is next for you? Have you got plans afoot for another book, or are you going to kind of take it easy for a while? And
well, I've become a grandmother recently.
Congratulations.
which is extraordinarily amazing that they're twins, 4 months old now.
Wow.
Twin girls. So I think, you know, part of the sort of reassessing my life is deciding, okay, how do I want to use my time? You know, how am I going to use this one wild and precious life? And part of it is realizing that what matters is family. What matters is the people we love and the world that we live in. So I'm going to continue with the activism in the best way I can. I'm going to be the best granny I can be to these two little girls. I'm exploring another novel. So I've got half a novel, and I'll get back to that and see if it has the drive that I think it probably has, and finish that. So that's my plan.
Do you have any social media that people can follow you on to keep up to date with anything you might be doing around the book publication?
Yes, I'm on Twitter. X, formerly Twitter, as
we still call it Twitter.
As at Liz Jensen Writer, and then I'm on Instagram, which I love, at Liz Jensen.
Fantastic. Liz, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you. Thank you.
Standard Issue, for all women.